For centuries, the Roma have wandered Europe. During the Holocaust, 500,000 were murdered. Throughout the Troubles, thousands of Irish travellers fled to England for safety. They found places to settle down, but then as Occupy was taking over Wall Street in London, the Dale Farm community was evicted from the land. Many did not leave their homes quietly. They put up a legal and at times a very physical fight. Catherine Quarmby takes us into the heat of the battle following a number of different families before and after the eviction from Dale Farm to Meriden and other so-called outlaw communities in her new book, No Place to Call Home. Catherine, good morning to you.
Good morning.
The book begins with the eviction of 80 or so Irish travellers from Dale Farm in October 2011. But that wasn't the first time you covered this story. Where did your involvement begin?
It began in actually on the last day of March in 2006 when I visited Dale Farm for the Economist newspaper. And to be honest, I was quite surprised with what I found there, because I suppose, like many people from the settled community, I was expecting quite a sort of untidy sight, and in fact, and maybe quite a not a welcoming a welcome committee. And in fact, I was very much welcomed by the travellers, and you know, absolutely spotless chalets. And so I suppose I then thought, well, if I was wrong about those two things, what else was I wrong about? And started looking at the Irish traveller community, and then of course English gypsies, and more recently newly arrived Roma as well.
Aside from your own preconceptions, and I think a lot of people would have shared those preconceptions, you describe Dale Farm as something of a paradox. In what way is it a paradox, or was it a paradox?
I suppose it's a paradox because it's come to represent, I suppose, for many people like from the settled community, this is what it's like to be a nomad today. And yet, in fact, for most people who would describe themselves as sort of nomads, it isn't really what nomadic life is like, in that most people live on small family sites and don't live in such big encampments. I mean, Dale Farm was enormous. Most English gypsies or Irish travellers wouldn't have invited activists onto a site and would sort of eschew publicity. So there were lots of things that were very different from Dale Farm as compared with the life that most English gypsies or Irish travellers would enjoy, which is a kind of quiet life away from publicity, a sort of quiet, sort of very family-based life, just sort of getting on with it, really. And Dale Farm yet became this kind of, you know, this epitome of what it meant to be a traveller, and it, in some ways, it really wasn't.
Now, you did a lot of research and you travelled quite a bit to actually put Dale Farm in context. Where did you go?
I went all over England, and you know, it's a great regret to me that you know, books don't really earn money these days, as you probably know. So I didn't have the money to come over to the Republic or to Northern Ireland, although I did obviously speak to a lot of Irish traveller families and did a lot of research with organisations in the Republic and Northern Ireland, and spoke to academics and so on. So I went to Scotland to visit newly arrived Roma. I went to Bristol to talk to new travellers, veteran new travellers who'd got sort of caught up in the sort of Thatcher backlash during the 1980s. Went up to Liverpool to visit the family of Johnny Delaney, a young Irish traveller boy who was kicked to death for being, in inverted commas, a gypsy. Of course, he was an Irish traveller boy. Went to visit some of the big religious meetings, and that was interesting in that obviously Irish travellers are culturally Catholics, but a big change is sort of sweeping the Irish traveller community in that many of them are becoming evangelical Christians. The Life and Light Church is becoming very important in the Irish traveller community. And obviously visited some of the really wonderful horse fairs in Stowe and Appleby, and sort of followed some of the families around as well, and went to not only to Dale Farm many, many times, but went to Meriden, another flashpoint of conflict in the Midlands as well.
Just tell us a little bit about Meriden. What happened? People will be familiar, I think, with Dale Farm. Meriden, perhaps not so much.
Yes, Meriden was very different from Dale Farm, because one thing that is really striking about Dale Farm is that everyone on all sides of the fence talked to journalists at Dale Farm. And I think that's something that was really great about Dale Farm, is that, you know, people were very open about the conflict and talked to each other as well. And I think that shows that there's a possibility of reconciliation there, and the possibility people might be able to live together in the future. At Meriden, it's a much more tricky situation in that you had a small group of English world Welsh and Scottish Romani gypsy families who moved onto a field which, like in Delfarm, they had bought but they didn't have planning permission for on a bank holiday weekend, as your listeners will know, that's often the case, in 2010. And unlike Delfarm, a residents committee then set up a very, very active sort of surveillance committee at the gates, sort of almost sort of under siege, to make sure they didn't move on earth digging equipment and make the field any bigger, which I don't think they were intending to do. But the residents were really cross that they'd moved on to Greenbelt land, which I think the English gypsies there were understood, but I think it was the surveillance that they were very concerned about, because they would be sort of, you know, going to their little wash house to clean their teeth and suddenly be photographed, which I think they found quite disturbing. So you had two groups of people who had good intentions on both sides and understandable worries, but came into this very, very bitter local conflict in a way that almost didn't happen at Delfarm, because even if people were cross and angry with each other, they actually still talked to each other, which was a really good thing about Delfarm.
Now, you hadn't written about travellers before visiting Delfarm in 2006 for The Economist, but your last book was a book called Scapegoat, and it was about hate crimes against people with disabilities. Did you find that there were any similarities between these two marginalised groups?
Yes, I think there are some similarities, and I think you could say that Irish travellers and English gypsies are also demonised to some extent by the media and by the public at large to some extent, that there's kind of long-term historical attitudes that govern some of our attitudes towards them. As I said, my own attitudes were, I think, to some extent quite negative when I first started looking at Irish travellers, and I had to sort of confront those and try and be quite neutral and kind of overcome them and think, well, actually I should take a community on their as they are rather than actually on my value system and see them as they are. And I think that's quite important, isn't it? And for instance, you know, we often, the communities are stereotyped as being criminal, and one of the things I look at in the book is unpicking that, and which is what I did with disabled people as well, because as your listeners might remember, back in the 80s and 90s, disabled people were actually feared because they were seen as people who might stab you because they'd just come out of institutions and were seen as all as mentally ill. And in fact, one of the great strengths of the disability movement has been to question that and show that disabled people can be victims of crime as well, and show that that was a very small proportion of people with schizophrenia who, if they weren't taking their medication, might do that. And I think one of the things we need to look at is to show that gypsies and travellers are also victims of crime, not just perpetrators. And I think that's something that really needs to be got across. So one of the things I've done is set crimes, you know, by gypsies and travellers in the wider context of the fact that they're also victims of really nasty hate crimes, and as well as also there are crimes within the community, you know, the stronger people in the community committing crimes against the weaker in the community. So you have to kind of look at all three components of criminality before you can really judge criminality as a whole. So for me, that's a very important way of looking at criminality as a whole. Otherwise, it's quite unfair.
Now, in your research, I think you found it difficult to get men to agree to talk to you. Why do you think that was?
Yes, I mean, that changed as I went on. In fact, you know, by the end, men were chatting to me quite a lot. But I think perhaps because I'm a woman, I tended to talk to women. There were some fantastic and articulate and forceful women. And perhaps there is, again, a bit of stereotyping about, you know, it being a very male-dominated society. You know, men go away and work as well. So perhaps there's also, you know, men aren't always there as well. They're absent because they're off, you know, following the work. So women are there in their chalets quite often. I did find by the end men would talk to me. They wouldn't always give their names if they were saying something controversial. So, for instance, at one point at Delfarm, some of the men were concerned about the fact that they might have to live on a new, smaller site with English gypsies. And they said, we don't think that's going to work because there would be feuding. And they were very concerned that that point got put across, but they didn't want to give their names. So by the end, they were talking to me. And older men would talk, but younger men who were out following the work were less keen to talk. But that, I think, is changing, as and certainly men in the church are very willing to talk. So perhaps there's a shift there, which is an interesting phenomenon in itself.
Did you talk to the women about domestic violence? Is there, I mean, obviously you can't absolutely definitively say, but anecdotally, would there be a higher level of domestic violence in the traveller community than in the settled community? Or is there any evidence to suggest that?
There's only one very small-scale study that suggests that there's a higher level of violence, and I think it's too early to say whether that in itself proves that. But I think we can say there's definitely studies that show that Irish traveller and English gypsy women suffer domestic violence for longer before they seek help. And that is understandable because there's only one refuge that takes in women that is specifically suited to their cultural needs. And so, and there's obviously, there can't be a caravan, a chalet that could take in women because it would get around where it was, so it wouldn't be safe. So we can definitely say that they will suffer violence, and that means they're more likely to die or commit suicide because they're suffering it for longer. And I think that is really shocking. And in fact, I detail the case of one woman who escaped her abusive husband, who then came back and found her and murdered her new husband in front of her. And I think that is the cost of not confronting domestic violence in the Irish Traveller and English Gypsy community, that the communities need policing like any other. And I think if they don't have confidence in the police, then that's not going to work. Communities can't self-police. They have to have confidence in the police or the Garda, in the case of the Irish Republic. And I don't. I think those links have to be built up, and that is happening. You know, Irish travellers in England are actually now on independent advisory groups with the police, which is fantastic and well respected. And I think that those links are starting to be built up, and so hopefully that will change.
You write about new travellers. Categorise those for me. Who are new travellers, or what are they?
Well, you may have seen some of them during the fracking pictures recently down in Balcombe in Sussex, actually. So they would be people who went on the road more out of economic distress in the 80s. So pushed out onto the road during the sort of Thatcherite era. Some went on the road because of choice. And in fact, you are seeing the beginning of some new travellers going out on the road again now because they can't afford conventional housing, which is quite interesting. There's definitely some emerging evidence on that. And mainly it's an economic necessity rather than a kind of lifestyle choice, though some people go out on the road as a lifestyle choice, the evidence seems to suggest. And so they are not a kind of ethnic group in the same way that Irish travellers are, you know, protected by law as an ethnic group, and English gypsies are protected by law as an ethnic group. And so their cultural choice to this nomadic lifestyle is recognised in law. So new travellers don't have the right to a nomadic lifestyle recognised in law. That means it's quite difficult for them to gain, you know, any rights to places on sites and so on. They had a difficult time of it in the 80s, and I think still have a difficult time because English gypsies and Irish travellers felt to some extent that the backlash against all of them under Thatcher was caused by their lifestyle choices. Whether that's fair or unfair is not for me to say.
Did the onset of the new Labour government of 1997, did that do anything positive for Britain's nomadic communities?
Yes, I think definitely. I think for the first time since Lord Avebury's Caravan Sites Act in 1968, which did lay a duty on local authorities to provide sites, this was the first time that we had money going into local authorities to provide sites, and it was a great step forward. And we did see local authorities providing sites, and families feeling that they could put money into providing sites for themselves. And it did change things. And also, there was definitely a feeling afoot. You know, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, our equality body in the UK, was also publishing reports pointing out that I think there was only the need for one square mile of land in the whole of the UK to provide all of the gypsy and traveller families in the UK with a site, which wasn't a tremendous amount of land. And I think when I first wrote my piece in 2006 for The Economist, at the current rate of increase then, it was estimated it would take something like 10 years to provide it. But at least the Labour government was sort of travelling in the right direction.
Right.
And of course, when the coalition came in, that stopped rather sort of precipitously.
Catherine, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. That's Catherine Quarmby. The book is called No Place to Call Home, Inside the Real Lives of Gypsies and Travellers. It's published by One World Publications and costs €18.50.